It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, recent data show the economy performed better than expected in the first part of 2019. We'll find out why that might be. First, at any given time, there are roughly 30 million people in therapy in the United States. If you've ever decided to see a therapist, you might be familiar with a feeling of uncertainty. What does my therapist think about me? Do they think my problems are dumb? Do they like me? What do? When they're not in the office. Our next guest shares her perspective from both sides of the equation, providing therapy to her patients and getting therapy herself after a big life setback. She says that experience can tell us a lot about our shared humanity. Lori Gottlieb is a psychotherapist, journalist, and writes the weekly column Dear Therapist for The Atlantic. Her latest book is called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Lori, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you write about something that you experience seeking therapy and that a lot of your patients or clients seek who are coming to you have, the presenting problem, the thing that prompts someone to go in and seek therapy. What was that thing for you?
So the presenting problem for me was an unexpected breakup. I was planning to marry the person that I was with, and he decided that he, with his kids going off to college, that he didn't want to live with a kid under his roof for the next 10 years, and that kid was my 8-year-old. And that's what lands me in therapy. But as I say in the book, often the presenting problem is kind of a red herring. It's the thing that gets you in there, but maybe not the thing you need to be working on.
And that's something that makes therapy, it seems like, difficult for both parties involved. The patient, the client, doesn't necessarily know what they're really in there for, the first visit or the first month or even the first year.
Right. Well, the first visit, I think, is about, here's something that happened, and whatever that is, I'm usually listening for the music under the lyrics. So what is the thing that got them into the situation in the first place? So I'm listening to what the content is of what they're saying, but I'm also listening for the underlying struggle or pattern.
Now, one might think that you, as you're going to seek therapy, you have all this experience providing therapy as a therapist, you would know how to get to things fast and avoid some of the common pitfalls that patients have. That wasn't really how it panned out, was it?
No, it wasn't how it panned out. And I think that's what's interesting is that when you're going through therapy, you're not really wearing your therapist's hat. I do everything with my therapist that my patients do with me. I wanted him to like me. When I'd see somebody in the waiting room as I was leaving, I'd wonder if, you know, he looked forward to her sessions more than mine. You know, I Google him at one point to find out more information. And I know that my patients do that with me because inevitably they slip up. They'll say something like, well, you know what it's like to raise a boy who's in middle school, even though I've never mentioned my son or his age or, you know, the fact that I'm a parent.
Now, in the book, you reveal a lot about yourself and the inside world of therapists. Why is this something you wanted the lay public to know about?
I feel like there are a lot of misconceptions about what therapy is, and I wanted to bring people behind the curtain and into the room to make it less mysterious or scary or confusing and just show people that it's a very rich human connection. And also, I think it normalizes our struggles to see other people going through things, because I think a lot of us feel very isolated in our struggles and we don't really talk about them. And I wanted people to know that this is how people get through them. This is how they grow and change. There are a lot of heroic moments that happen in the therapy room, and I wanted people to see that.
That reminds me of something I've been noticing lately, often on social media. It seems like, just in my observations, people are more willing to talk about whether they're seeking therapy or their struggles with mental health concerns. Do you see that happening, and do you see that as a positive development, if so?
I do see that happening, and I think it's very positive. I think it used to be that we talk about our physical health openly. You know, I'm having chest pain, but we would never talk about our emotional pain. And I think that the more people who talk about the fact that they're human, which means that they struggle because there's no such thing as a human who doesn't struggle, the more that people will, first of all, feel less isolated in their experience, but second of all, get help when they need it.
Talking to Lori Gottlieb about her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. Lori, you write that there's a pitfall in real life sometimes when people find out you're a therapist. They get a little edgy talking to you. What kind of things do you run into?
Well, I think that people have strange reactions to that. Sometimes they immediately want to get away from you. You know, if you're at a barbecue, they'll escape for a drink. But I think also some people will say things like, well, can you help me with this problem with my mother-in-law? Or are you going to psychoanalyze me? Which I think is really funny, because if I were a gynecologist, nobody would say, well, are you going to give me a pelvic exam right now? So why would I psychoanalyze you at this barbecue or this dinner party?
And another challenge that I hadn't really thought of, you don't necessarily control who walks in your door, and people might present initially as unsympathetic. Can you tell us a little bit? You share some case studies with the names changed, the permission of your clients, and heavily redacted and whatnot. But tell us about John and your initial thoughts about him.
Yeah, I really wanted to include John because when we first meet him, he's incredibly abrasive. He tells me that the reason that he's coming to me is because I'm a nobody, and so he won't run into any of his high-powered colleagues in my waiting room.
Gee, thanks.
He's charming in the beginning. But I think what's interesting is that, you know, he tells me that he doesn't want his wife to know that he's going to therapy, so he hands me a wad of cash at the end of the session and says I'll be just like his mistress, nobody has to know. And, you know, he's very insulting to me. He keeps people at bay, and I think that why I wanted to include him is that he really shows that once we understand why somebody behaves the way they do, which is a way to protect themselves, a way to keep themselves safe, we start to see their humanity. And in the book, he becomes the person that readers love the most. He's the person that, interestingly, they hate at the beginning and they come to really love, as do I, by the way, when I go through the work with him. And once we see the tragedy and the trauma underneath his behavior, you know, we start to see how much we have in common with him, even though he seems so different from us at the beginning.
Yeah, I want to ask how you get past that initial reaction, because this guy, I mean, if you wrote a cliche, big shot Hollywood executive character who everybody hates, this is how he presents himself when he first interacts with you. How do you either reserve judgment or back off on initial judgments of a patient?
You know, right. A supervisor had said to me when I was doing my internship, she said, there's something likable about everyone. It's your job to find it. And I think that was such wise advice, because there really is something likable about everyone if I can get to see them. If they keep, you know, keeping me at bay, if they distract me with tangent after tangent, if I try to focus them and they run away from me, it's going to be hard to know whether I like them. But once I see them, I always find something likable in them. And so I think that having that in mind helps me to know that I need to be patient, I need to assess their readiness to hear something, I need to plant seeds along the way to get them ready to hear something. My job is really to hold up a mirror to people and to help them see themselves in a new way, in a way that maybe they haven't, but other people have, so that they can make changes and navigate life more smoothly.
One of the big challenges in doing that, though, is both in John's case with you as the therapist, and then your case with your therapist, who you call Wendell in the book, both you and John are resistant to tackling head-on some of those issues that the therapist is seeing, is trying to navigate toward, and it takes a while. How do you negotiate that over the course of multiple sessions?
I think you have to form a relationship with the person where they start to trust you and they start to realize that you're on the same side. I think out in the world it's very hard to hear some of these things about ourselves, because we hear them as criticisms or judgments or insults. And in the therapy room, we hear them as information that's very helpful. And it's not just information, because we have this saying in the therapy room that insight is the booby prize of therapy, that you can have all the insight in the world, but if you don't make changes out in the world, the insight is useless. So you might say in therapy, oh, now I understand why I keep getting in arguments in my marriage. But if you go home and you do exactly the same thing in your marriage, the insight and the therapy are useless. So we help people to understand things about themselves, but we also expect them to make changes between sessions when they're out in the world, and we support them in those changes every week.
We're talking to Lori Gottlieb, a psychotherapist, journalist, writer of the weekly column Dear Therapist for The Atlantic. We're talking about a new book. It's called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been in therapy yourself? Has it made you understand what it means to be you, to be a human, a little differently than when you started? You ever wonder what your therapist thinks about you? If you're a therapist yourself, what do you wish patients, what do you wish people in the world, maybe pop culture, would understand about being a therapist? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Lori Gottlieb. She's a psychotherapist, journalist, and writer of the weekly column Dear Therapist for The Atlantic. We're talking about her new book. It's called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gone in to seek therapy? What was that experience like for you? Did you come out on the other side of it happier? Knowing something about yourself that you didn't know before. If you are a therapist yourself, love to hear about your experiences and what you wish the rest of us knew about the job that you do. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Jim is with us in Fond du Lac. Jim, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a friend who lost his wife in the last year to cancer. And I know he has sought out some therapy, and at this point in time, he's kind of in a really dark place. And I'm just not sure where to go. I'm trying to be a friend. I'm trying to not do the wrong thing or interfere in any way. But with what he's seen for help, the other situation is his job, I would say, is in a situation where he's a pastor.
Mm.
And he not only has to worry about himself, but all of his congregants at the same time.
Jim, thank you so much for calling, and thanks for being willing to be a good friend to your pastor friend. Lori, do you have insights gained from being a therapist and seeking therapy on how the rest of us, for that friend or family member in our life who's going, as Jim said, through a dark time, can help out?
One of the things I write about in the book is I write a lot about grief, and there's a woman who's dying of cancer in the book, and somebody else who's lost a child in the book. And the thing about grief is I think a lot of times people want to make their friends feel better, and what people really need is someone to sit with them where they are. Sometimes you just need to know that you're not alone, even though grief is a very isolating experience. That you need sometimes to just know that people care about you and love you, and that there's nothing they can say or do to bring back the person that you lost, but they can be there with you now. And it takes time, and you're not going to see anything immediately in terms of, you know, how the person feels, and they're going to have good days and bad days, but just be with them where they are.
Thanks for that call, Jim. And one thing that doesn't seem to help in real life, and as I've read some in your book too, is saying, well, you know, at least this worst thing isn't happening to you. That doesn't tend to work for someone in the middle of grieving.
No, it doesn't. And saying, you know, well, you can always marry someone else, you know, it's not going to make them feel better. And people don't say things, you know, that obtuse, but they do say some things that are, you know, I think people... It makes the person who's trying to comfort the person feel better, but it makes the person that they're trying to comfort feel worse.
And Jim reminds me, he's talking about his pastor friend, right, going through this dark experience and having to help parishioners in some ways as a counselor himself. You were there, you know, after this breakup, you were seeking therapy yourself, but trying to hold it together to work with your patients. How do you compartmentalize that?
Yeah, self-care is so important, especially for people who are working in the helping professions. And we have weekly consultation groups where we go to talk about our cases. And if we're really struggling with something, we go to our own therapy, as this friend of his has done as well.
We heard from Deborah. Deborah emailed to ask if seeing a therapist that's the same gender as you makes a difference for people opening up to their therapist. And that's interesting in your case, Lori, because you actually sought out a guy, right?
I did, and I did that quite intentionally, which was that I wanted to see someone who fit the profile of the boyfriend who broke up with me, you know, who was somebody who he happened to be married. My boyfriend was divorced, but who, you know, had kids and was a family person, because I wanted to go for validation. I wanted the therapist to say, you're right, you dodged a bullet, you know, that any sort of, you know, family-oriented guy would see this. But that's not what therapy is about. Therapy isn't there for validation. You're there to see something about yourself in a different way. I think it completely depends on what you're wanting in terms of the gender of the therapist that you choose. Some people very specifically want to work with somebody, maybe the same gender feels more comfortable for them. Maybe if they didn't have a good experience with that growing up, they might want to go to somebody of the opposite gender. But really, it's about the relationship with your therapist. And when you go in the room, what does it feel like to talk to this person? Do you feel understood? Is this person easy to talk to? And, you know, more than gender, that's going to be your barometer of whether it's the right fit.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Jessica is with us in Barron. Jessica, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, I recently have had my son, he's a teenager, in therapy just for a lot of different teenager-related issues, but we had some specifics that we went there for, and it wasn't his first time in therapy. But I just sort of felt like it was a chat session, an hour at a time, and okay, I'll see you in 3 weeks. There was no plan. There was no let's work on this between now and the next time. I was wondering if you could talk about when to know if you're not getting anything out of the experience and how to choose a good therapist.
Interesting, yeah. Jessica. Thanks. Lori, what do you think?
It's very important that both of you are aware of what is the goal. What are some of the goals when you come in? It's not just a chat session. I think sometimes it can look like that even when the goals are defined, but it's important to know what the goals are. The therapist is being should be very intentional and strategic in guiding the conversation, in what they're talking about, in helping your child to open up about what's not working and what are some of the issues and why. What I find is that teenagers love going to therapy. They don't like being told to go to therapy. But once they're there, they often love it because there's somebody that they can talk to that's different from their friends who often don't really know what's going on and, you know, they're as confused as the teenager. And they don't want to talk to their parents about this. And they have a trusted adult that they can talk to. If that's not happening for this child, then, you know, I would talk to the therapist and try to get more information about what is going on and what are the goals. And hopefully the therapist can clarify that for you.
Jessica, thanks for that call. We're talking to Lori Gottlieb about her new book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. That said, Lori, I imagine between any two people, sometimes two people just don't click. How does a therapist know, or how does a patient know, maybe this just isn't the right pairing, this isn't working for anybody?
Well, actually, in the book, I write about just that situation where I'm seeing someone and she finds me very ineffective, and yet she won't leave. And so it's sort of this dance that we're doing, and eventually I have to end the therapy with her. And I've never done that since, and I hadn't done that up to that point. But I don't want to waste people's time, and I really want people to be in the right place. So I think that, you know, most therapists want to help you and not waste your time, and if the relationship is not effective, then people, you know, will give you a referral, or they'll say, hey, this, you know, I don't know that the work we're doing here is helping you.
Jessica, thanks again for the call. We heard from Brandy on Facebook. Brandy says, therapy is like anything. If you say it won't work and you're not honest with yourself, it won't work. If you're open-minded, Brandy writes, and you're ready to look at things honestly, this is a safe place to do it. What, Lori, kind of attitude for someone seeking therapy, maybe for the first time, what kind of attitude will help accomplish what Brandy's talking about there?
That's such a good point, because when people come to therapy, I'm not just interested in why they're there, but I'm interested in why now. Why this day, this week, this month did the person call me when maybe the problem has persisted for longer? Because I'm not only looking at what's not working, but I'm scanning for strengths. And one of those strengths is readiness. How ready is this person to make changes? How ready is this person to look at some things that maybe are hard to look at? And so I want to assess that in the first session so that I know how quickly we can move. I know, you know, where we might need to go first before we get there. I'm really looking for what strengths I can build on to get them as ready as possible to make the kinds of changes that will help them.
Lori, one thing that struck me in your book that I honestly hadn't thought of before is if you're a therapist, you've got this intense relationship, you're getting this incredibly personal information, this inside story of a person. And at some point, one way or another, that relationship ends. Maybe you're done, everything's worked, they move on with their lives. What's it like to have that intimate view of someone and then just not know what comes next?
It's a unique relationship in that way, because it's I think it's one of the very few relationships in life where you know that you're going to go into a relationship, form a very an intimate relationship with this person, and then say goodbye. And I don't know that we go into any other relationship knowing that it's going to end in that way. It might end, but this one we know for sure is going to end. So, but I think that one of the things that's nice about therapy is I think that any relationship we have stays with us. And I think that sometimes our voices as therapists stay with our patients and vice versa, that some things that we've learned from them stay with us. One of the things that a lot of my patients say is that they've learned to be kinder to themselves through therapy, that they listen to the voices in their heads that used to be so critical and judgmental, and they realize that, you know, if they said this to their friends, they would not have any friends, you know. And they really change the way that they have compassion for themselves, which means they take responsibility for their actions, but they don't have to self-flagellate while they do it. And I think that sometimes that critical voice gets replaced with the therapist's voice even after therapy ends.
It's a good place to leave it. Lori, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Lori Gottlieb. She's a psychotherapist, a journalist, and she writes the weekly column Dear Therapist over at The Atlantic. She joined us to talk about her latest book. It's called Maybe You Should Talk to Someone, A Therapist, Her Therapist, and Our Lives Revealed. If you'd like to share something about your own experience seeking therapy or providing therapy, there is still time to do that. You can head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and join the conversation there with your thoughts and your experiences. Coming up after the news, despite a big government shutdown to kick off the year, the economy performed better than expected in the first quarter of 2019. We'll look at what fed into that, why it happened, and with the Wisconsin economist, whether it might continue. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Boy Scouts have been rocked by a sex abuse scandal involving thousands of victims over several decades. We'll find out what the organization knew and when, and lawsuits in the works. First, the United States economy did better than expected, according to data released last week by the Commerce Department. Gross domestic product, or GDP, rose at a 3.2% annual rate in the first 3 months of the year. That was better than many observers had predicted after fears of an economic hangover from the longest government shutdown in American history. Abdur Chaudhry is here with us now to take a closer look at those numbers and explain how we got here. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Economics at Marquette University. Abdur, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, Abdur, I'm seeing the word unexpected thrown around a lot to describe these economic numbers. Why were these GDP numbers surprisingly high?
Yeah, we were pleasantly surprised with the number. We were expecting somewhere around 2.5% GDP growth, but it turned out to be 3.2%. There are two main reasons for that. One is we saw a significant improvement in our net trade position. Our exports went up, imports went down. And also, we did see increase in inventory investments. So those were the two factors that sort of pushed the GDP figure to 3.2%.
Now, GDP is one measure of the economy. It's really a big, large-scale picture. How important is that as a number when we evaluate the health of our economy?
Obviously, GDP gives you an overall picture. There may be some points of weakness within the economy, but by looking at GDP, we can basically say that the fundamentals in the economy are strong, and we do have a healthy economy.
Now, President Trump addressed this new economic data last week. Here's a bit of what he had to say.
We have great growth and also very, very low inflation. Our economy is doing great. Number one in the world. We're number one economy right now in the world, and it's not even close.
Is that accurate, Abdur? We are the number one economy in the world, depending on how you want to define that?
We are number one in terms of the total value of our GDP. But, for example, if you look at the GDP growth rate, then obviously we are not number one. But we are the biggest, the largest economy in the world.
What, speaking of the world, how much does something like our GDP depend on, say, the economies of the European Union or China, for example?
It does depend to some extent. For example, if you take the case of the European Union, the recent problem that we see in Brexit, the United Kingdom trying to leave the European Union, that sort of creates uncertainty in the global economy, which in turn affects the U.S. economy. Also, China is one of our major trading partners. So if China is not doing well, that would also have a negative impact on the U.S. economy.
Again, the GDP, it's a large-scale measure, looking pretty good. Stock market has done pretty well. Do people feel that? How do we measure whether these things, these good numbers with the GDP, are impacting, say, how much lower-income workers are making at the workplace?
If you look at the workers' wages, that's slightly different. The labor market is doing very well. Unemployment rate is at one of the lowest level we have seen in decades. However, one thing that we found is that wage rate has not increased at the rate that we would have expected, given the tight labor market. We are creating a lot of jobs. If you look at the job creation numbers that come out every month, we are creating a lot of jobs, but many of these jobs are in the low-skilled, low-wage areas. We are not creating enough job in high-skilled, high-wage areas. As a result, you know, wages are not increasing that much. So recent statistics that has come out shows that the degree of income inequality in the country has increased in the last decade.
This is as this economic recovery is going on, this rise in inequality. Can you talk a little more about what's driving that? It's the more low-skilled jobs, fewer high-skilled jobs. And what's happening at the top end of the economy?
At the top end of the economy, if you look at the top 1%, top 2%, it's basically, if you look at the stock market is doing very well. So wealth is increasing at the top end. But the wages at the lower end are not increasing at a similar rate. So we see the disparity increasing over time.
Talking to Abdur Chaudhry, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Economics at Marquette University, looking at pretty good economic numbers, higher than expected GDP numbers that came out last week for the first quarter of 2019. Abdur, politically, some people might describe this as year 10 of the Obama recovery or year 2 of the Trump rally. How much does a president and presidential policies and congressional policies actually impact the economy, or are these just trends that are kind of outside of anybody's control?
To be honest, the president doesn't have a very significant impact on how the overall economy is going. I would say the Federal Reserve Bank has a bigger role to play in the economy, given, you know, whatever policy they follow has a greater impact on the economy. So the president obviously takes the credit. To some extent, that's correct, but I don't think the president can take full credit for the state of the economy.
Let's talk about the Federal Reserve a little more. There's a debate going on that the president is part of, the idea that, okay, the economy is doing well, now's the time to raise interest rates. The president and others saying, whoa, if you raise interest rates, you're going to slow things down. But other people saying, wait a minute, if we go into a recession, interest rates are as low as they are, we don't have a lot of tools to fight that recession. How do you untangle all of that?
Towards the end of last year, as you know, the Federal Reserve Bank started to raise interest rates because the economy was doing very well. Then early this year, because the global economy was slowing down a little bit and inflation in the U.S. was not increasing, as a result, the Federal Reserve Bank decided not to raise interest rate in the near future. And I don't think the Fed will raise interest rates in 2019. having said that, the issue of recession, late last year or early this year, there was some question that, you know, are we close to a recession, because the yield curve became negative. And if you look at previous recessions, a couple of months before the recession sets in, the yield curve turned negative. So, you know, some people started to question whether we are close to a recession. But personally, I feel that the economy is fundamentally strong, so I don't see a recession happening in the next 12 months.
There have been times of economic expansion in the past where we've seen some people say, hey, maybe this time is different. Maybe we can just see steady growth forever. Another recession isn't going to come. Then another recession comes. Is this time different? Is there such a thing as just ongoing sustained expansion? Or are we going to hit a recession again sometime, even if not in the next year?
Obviously, we will hit a recession sometime. You know, the economy goes through business cycles, you know, ups and downs. But given the sustained growth in the economy and given the strong fundamentals that we see, we don't see a recession in the very near future. Maybe there will be a recession 2 years or 5 years down the road, but I don't see that happening in the next year or so.
Pretty positive for the most part. Are there any worrisome signs that you see buried within the happier numbers?
There are a couple of headwinds. There are a couple of things that we should be concerned about. In the domestic economy, I would say the housing sector. You know, the last great recession we had was basically started from the housing sector. We don't see much improvement in the housing sector the way we'd like to see. There has been some positive movements, but the housing sector has not improved the way we would like to see. That's in the domestic economy. In the global side, I think the Brexit issue is something that we need to be concerned about, because the uncertainty that we have, the UK was supposed to leave the European Union by the end of March. Now, that has been pushed back to end of October, but the resulting uncertainty is creating some problem both globally as well as for the U.S.
And Abdur, I want to ask you about policies that might help people who are left behind even in the midst of this expansion. I'm thinking of groups like farmers, especially dairy farmers in Wisconsin, a lot of them struggling, and also high school workers with a high school education who maybe in years past, generations past, might have gotten a really good paying factory job. Now they're getting a lower paying service job at best. Do you see policies that could help people in those two groups?
For the high school graduates, I would say more technical education would prepare them for the workplace in the manufacturing sector. Because if you look at the manufacturing sector, what we have seen in Wisconsin is that employers are looking for workers, but they're not finding the type of skills that they're looking for. So technical education for high school graduates would be a good point to start.
And for dairy farmers, this is we could spend hours just talking about this issue. Do you see any hopeful signs for them after many years of low milk prices?
This, to some extent, is related and linked to the NAFTA issue, because what we have seen is we get a lot of competition in dairy products and lumbers, for example, from Canada. So if we can have a good NAFTA agreement with Canada, the Trump administration has come to some sort of an agreement. Now, that needs to be ratified by the U.S. Congress. So that would help the dairy farmers in Wisconsin.
And Abdur, in our last minute or so, what are some of the next indicators, the next reports, the next numbers you're watching for?
Obviously, the next numbers that I would be watching for is on Friday. The labor market numbers are coming out. The job creation, that's a number that I'd be looking for. Also, numbers from the housing market, because that's some concern that I have. The housing market is not improving the way we'd like to see. So housing market numbers, labor market, those are the numbers we'd be looking at.
We'll leave it there for now. Abdur, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Okay, thank you for having me in your program. Thank you.
We've been talking to Abdur Chaudhry, Professor Emeritus in the Department of Economics over at Marquette University. He joined us for a look at the economy's strong performance in the first part of 2019, what's behind it, and what to watch for in the months to come. Coming up, we'll find out about allegations of widespread sexual abuse within the Boy Scouts of America on the eve of what looks like maybe a bunch more lawsuits. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the latest attack on a house of worship and discuss what's behind the violence and how churches, synagogues, mosques, and other religious centers are responding. Now, allegations of sexual abuse by leaders in the Boy Scouts have been known about for several years and have been the basis of several lawsuits. But a few new developments have brought the issue to the forefront, and victims are being encouraged to come forward now, in part because of changing laws in some states, making it possible to bring civil suits and criminal charges. Joseph Theavila is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, has been following the story. Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about this release of information from a law firm about allegations of abuse at the Boy Scouts of America?
Sure. So we had a law firm recently come forward and disclose some information regarding allegations of abuse with the Boy Scouts. And so what happened was there was an unrelated lawsuit that was happening in Minnesota where a person by the name of Janet Warren, she's a professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia. She was hired by the Boy Scouts to examine the organization's database of volunteers and members that have been suspected of violating its policies. And basically, these people have been taken out of the Boy Scouts. And this information dates back decades. So in a court case, she testified that her team had identified more than 12,000 victims and nearly 18,000 people who were on this list that the Boy Scouts kept, and they have been referred to as the perversion files. And so a lot of these people were accused of sexually abusing Boy Scouts. And this is going back, I believe, as far as the 1960s.
And now we've got this question of why now. There's a change in laws in a couple states, New York and New Jersey, that might make it possible for people, for victims to come forward and sue where they couldn't have previously, right?
That's correct. Both of those states have recently passed laws that will include this so-called look-back provision, where these alleged incidents that took place that may have been time-barred because of statute of limitations, they're opening up these temporary windows where people will now be able to sue. They'll be able to sue the alleged perpetrator, and they would be able to sue the organization that that perpetrator belonged to. So in this case, the Boy Scouts themselves, the organization, could be named in a lawsuit. And so in addition to these states, you have other states like California and Pennsylvania, where they're also considering similar laws. And because of all this attention, a lot more victims are coming forward and are showing interest in bringing lawsuits.
Now, these laws will also relate, as I understand it, to the Catholic Church. A lot of the scandal in the Catholic Church was the idea that, okay, a priest might be caught or reported abusing a young church member in one place and then moved somewhere else and then repeating that behavior again. Are there indications or allegations that that has happened in the Boy Scouts? So we've stopped you from being a scoutmaster in one place, but you pick up and do it again somewhere else.
Well, this is something that the Boy Scouts themselves have denied. They say that basically that once a person gets put on this list, they are removed from the Boy Scouts, and they say that they have a very low threshold for removing people, and it's not even if they've been accused of a crime or if they've even been convicted. Sometimes it's even if they're allegations that they violated internal Boy Scouts policies, the Boy Scouts say they remove these folks.
There have been lawsuits previous to this, right, against Boy Scouts of America, now called, I think, Scouts BSA. What have we seen in terms of lawsuits against the organization?
We've seen several. We've seen many that have been going out throughout the years, and a lot of those lawsuits kind of paved the way for some of the information that we now know in terms of the records that the Boy Scouts were keeping on these alleged perpetrators. A lot of the information came out in those court cases where the court ordered them to release a lot of this information. And so a lot of these files have been in the public domain, available through the courts, since around 2012. And since then, there have been even more people that have come forward. And as these new laws either taking place in places like New York or New Jersey, or as other places consider changing their laws, even more people are considering filing litigation against the Boy Scouts.
We're talking to Joseph Theavila from the Wall Street Journal. He's a U.S. news reporter there, talking about lawsuits against the Boy Scouts, more likely down the road, accusations of abuse at the organization. Talk about, Joseph, the wider response from the Boy Scouts to these accusations. What kind of things have they said about their organization and how they try to protect the boys in the organization?
Well, they've said that they've taken numerous actions to ensure that children are kept safe. In a recent conference call with reporters, they noted that in the last year, in 2018, that they were only aware of 5 allegations of sexual abuse, and they say this is much lower than what you see out in the general public or general society. And so, and the other thing that they note is that this database that they've kept of these perpetrators, alleged perpetrators, many people are put on this list just for even being suspected of violating Boy Scout policy. And they say that keeping this list and having this list of people who even come close to violating policy has kept kids safe.
And I understand the organization itself is looking at filing bankruptcy. What's behind that?
Well, they are getting hit with just so many lawsuits that it's becoming a little bit difficult for the organization to manage. And this does pose a threat to the future of the organization. So given the large number of lawsuits that they are facing and more that could be on the way, they are considering filing bankruptcy. And this would basically allow for a more kind of orderly process. It would temporarily halt future lawsuits. So once this happens, no more lawsuits would be able to be filed for a while. And then a judge would oversee the process, which would include searching for more victims, either through ad campaigns and mailings. So this would allow more people to come forward and would create a more orderly process for them to get their day in court. And in the long run, it could be easier for victims to receive compensation through this process. And for the Boy Scouts, it allows them to have this all under one roof to deal with these rather than dealing with hundreds of individual lawsuits all over the country.
And now the clock is ticking. These laws in New York and New Jersey, you mentioned there's a 1-year period where people can file lawsuits and kind of exempt themselves in a way from statutes of limitations. When do those laws start kicking into effect?
In New York, they take effect in August. And in New Jersey, the governor there who said he will sign the legislation, but that's still pending, that would go into effect in December. And yes, it would create these temporary windows that would allow anyone to bring forward a lawsuit no matter what time period the alleged abuse occurred. In addition to that, there's also some other expansions in those states of statute of limitations that victims would be able to still bring lawsuits even after those temporary windows have ended. It's going to vary by state, and it's going to vary by the age of the victim.
And so do you expect to see, as we wrap up, a lot of lawsuits once those laws start coming online?
Absolutely. Even now, I've already spoken with a team of attorneys that have already reached over 200 victims who have shown interest in filing lawsuits. And these are people who are all over the country, not just in these states where they've changed the laws. So there is definitely interest that's being expressed out there for victims that want to move forward and try to get their day in court. And it's happening all over the country.
Joseph, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Joseph Theavila is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He joined us to talk about why the issue of sexual abuse of children enrolled in the Boy Scouts is back in the news and what might happen in the next few months as we've been hearing some states' new laws kick into effect. ending the statute of limitations on civil and criminal charges, and other states around the country consider similar laws related to sexual abuse when cases can be filed in criminal and civil courts. We'll be watching that story in the months to come. Picture two great scenes from the City of London. One, Big Ben, the dignified clock tower. Two, the London Marathon. Get them together and what do you get? Bad news. A runner wearing a Big Ben costume in this weekend's London Marathon was trying to set a record for the fastest marathon run in a landmark costume. One snag, he got snagged, literally, when his tower got stuck on the overhang of the finish line. Well, Chris Molina, producer, is here. You've seen people, you run. From time to time, I don't.
I have been known to run. And occasionally you do see people in wacky costumes, and I have mad respect for these people because, you know, running a marathon is hard enough. Doing it when you're dressed up as a giant clock, also very difficult. But you see people with really creative costumes. And so I was thinking about a race that I did last year. It was a Halloween race, so everyone was kind of dressed up. But there were two women in the race who were wearing kind of those wacky inflatable tube guy costumes, like the things you see at the used car dealership.
Right.
And so it's one thing to wear the costume the whole time during the race, but they also committed to like flailing their arms around the entire time.
What was the length of this race?
This was a 10K. So, okay. I mean, that's like 6-point-something miles. So they really committed to this. And you know what? I appreciate it. And I also appreciate that there is a world record for running a marathon in a landmark costume. That's a thing.
Question. With the floppy person costume, what did the people, were they like whapping the other runners in the face as they went along?
I would be worried that your baggy sleeve would hit the ground and somebody would step on it and you would just topple
over.
Just
go down.
They made it.
The agony of defeat. Chris, thanks. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.